Hello, Juno, and welcome to the April 22nd edition of Juno Afternoon. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. We've got a great show today. We'll get the details about infant immunization and World Immunization Week. We'll talk to Anchorage-born author Lee Newman about her book, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. We'll get information about the workshops during Money Smart Week, and we'll get a preview of this weekend's performance by Theater at Latitude 58, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more. But right now, we'll go to National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes from Northern Plains reservations traveled to Washington, D.C. last week to highlight poor housing conditions in Indian country. Matt Laszlo reports.
The facade of a dilapidated gray house rests on the back of a flatbed truck near the U.S. Capitol. It traveled 1,500 miles from the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. The walls were taken from the original 33-by-38 two-bedroom, one-bathroom structure where 1 month before, 13 people were living. It's not an extraordinary situation in Pine Ridge, according to Emma Pinky Clifford, director of the Oglala Sioux Tribe Partnership for Housing.
That's normal. Typical. It could be 12 to 18.
The Oglala Sioux Housing Authority was established in 1961 to reorganize the system of housing assistance provided to Native Americans through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The house on display is from that original stock from more than 50 years ago. Paul Ironcloud, executive director of the Oglala Sioux Housing Authority, is in charge of more than 1,000 active homes on the reservation. But he says the growing population really necessitates closer to 4,000 homes. But because of federal budget cuts, the housing authorities lost more than $1 million. Now they can only provide about 10 new houses a year. Herb Many Horses explains.
So, you know, we're taking our sequestration cuts as, you know, as everybody is. But it's been draconian arc, the cuts, because they're so small to begin with.
And Clifford says the problem isn't just building new homes, but providing maintenance and upkeep to existing houses, as the frayed and splitting wood of the facade attests, and to the communities where those homes are located.
You know, a house requires a lot of other things with it, and every one of those pieces needs funding, too, to address. So even if we were to get 50 homes this year, you would have to have other agencies on the reservation who had funding to complete the homes. In other words, the infrastructure, the road, the water, the utilities.
Sarah Crawford, an aide to South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson, says the lack of decent housing on the Pine Ridge Reservation doesn't just affect the physical well-being of its residents, but has long-lasting and continual societal effects as well.
Yeah, housing, it is a cornerstone of all everything, because a lot of things in Indian country are very cyclical. If you don't have one thing, something else is going to happen, and it's going to be a problem after problem.
Clifford and Ironcloud hope that bringing a representation of those housing problems to Washington will move lawmakers to reauthorize the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act later this year. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency is concluding the comment period today on the way tribes seek emergency and major disaster declarations. Toby Scott has more.
Until recently, tribes impacted by disaster have had to apply for federal assistance through state governors. Now, as the result of an amendment to the Stafford Act, tribal governments are able to appeal for emergency aid directly to the president. Among the issues raised by tribal leaders is the question of matching funds. Under existing FEMA rules, states must provide up to 25% of recovery funding to be eligible for federal aid. More than a dozen tribal leaders have expressed concern that this percentage is too high for tribal governments to manage. Among them is Lorianne Rawson of South Naknek Native Village, who raised the issue in an earlier teleform with federal officials.
Our tribe currently has absolutely no revenue. Our tribal unemployment is in excess of 90%. So the 25% for match from our tribe is virtually impossible.
In March, the Eastern Band of Cherokee and the Navajo Nation became the first tribes in the country to receive disaster declarations directly from the president. For National Native News, I'm Toby Scott.
The Navajo Nation is recognizing its sovereignty with a holiday. The tribe's president, Ben Shelley, says today the tribe remembers a 1980s decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. The court recognized the tribe's ability to tax without the approval of the Secretary of the Interior. Navajo Nation Sovereignty Day was created in May 1985. During this month in 2012, the Cherokee Nation enacted the Free Press Protection and Journalist Shield Act. The law protects journalists from disclosing certain information in tribal proceedings. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, Juno. You are listening to KTOO. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Joan Pardis. The weather today, it is raining. Highs around 47, southeast wind at 10 miles per hour. Tonight, it's cloudy with a chance of rain. And then Tuesday, it looks like mostly cloudy, rain likely Tuesday night. And then for the rest of the week, the same old rain, sometimes cloudy, maybe some sun peeking out by the weekend. So I guess it's after a great weekend, it's time for us all to do our laundry and clean our house a little bit. Here in the studio, we have Kate Helfrich from the Public Health Center, and she is here to talk about World Immunization Week. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. So tell me a little bit about World Immunization Week.
Sure. So World Immunization Week is actually an initiative that is put on by the World Health Organization. And what the World Health Organization is trying to do is they're trying to motivate their international, national partners, all the way down to the community level, to get their partners together to help unify with one voice, everybody saying that we support immunizations, and to kind of get the word out there on how immunizations really do save lives. So with World Immunization Week, the United States has decided to take that on and take that mission on, and the way that the United States is doing that is through National Infant Immunization Week.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds great. So immunizations avert an estimated, according to the World Health Organization's website, an estimated 2 to 3 million deaths every year.
That is correct.
But the data still shows that an estimated 22 million infants are not fully immunized with routine vaccines. And these are international numbers, I would imagine.
Yes, those are international numbers, yes. And it does, it highlights a very important point, though, that many people aren't vaccinated, and as our communities, as our world becomes more mobile, we have to keep that in mind, that things travel very easily, whether it be on planes, on barges, on ships, and in areas where immunizations may not be as prevalent as they are in the United States, it's easy to bring things back, and that puts a lot of people at risk in your own communities. So that's another reason why it's very important to get immunized. I think there is lots of myths out there, and one of the myths is that we don't see these diseases anymore. They're eradicated. But they might not be as right at the ground level here in our community, but they are somewhere else. And it's really important that we understand that we can transport those back to our communities. And so it is important to have those vaccinations available and to receive them so that we're preventing those illnesses in our communities.
Okay, speaking of our communities, what is going on in Alaska, in Southeast Alaska, in Juneau for World Immunization Week?
Well, that's a great question. World Immunization Week here in the United States, as National Infant Immunization Week, we as a public health center will be offering immunizations, which we do year-round, but this week is special. We'll be offering them with no administration fees, so it's absolutely free to come and get an immunization at the Juno Public Health Center as long as you qualify. There are some eligibility criteria. You can get more information on that by calling the Juno Public Health Center. Our phone number is 465-3353, and we're located across from the Twin Lakes parking lot. And if you have questions for future, if you want more information about vaccines, public health nurses are a great resource, and we'd be happy to answer any of your questions. So this week, the vaccines are by appointment, and they're not just for infants, but we do offer Tdap for adults as well, and some other vaccines if you are eligible for adults. Those will also be free. We won't be charging any administration fees for those.
So what is a Tdap immunization?
Great question. So a Tdap is one of our vaccines. It's T stands for tetanus, the D is for diphtheria, and the AP, the app, that's actually pertussis, more commonly known as whooping cough. So that is one of the adult vaccines that we're carrying currently. Anyone with children might be more familiar with the DTaP, which is the childhood version of the Tdap. We like to switch the letters around and use some acronyms there. So the Tdap is for adults, the DTaP for children. It is a relatively recent recommendation that adults receive a one-time dose of Tdap. Historically, adults were recommended to get a tetanus shot every 5 to 10 years. That is still the case. What we're asking, though, is that adults also make sure that one of those tetanus-containing vaccines that they received in their adult life have the whooping cough portion in it. The reason for that is we used to think of whooping cough as just a childhood illness, and what we're seeing now is that more adults are getting whooping cough. It might not be severe, but what they're doing is passing it on to those infants that we're unable to vaccinate because they're too young. And whooping cough in infants can be very deadly.
Hmm. And what is the prevalence of whooping cough in Alaska or in Southeast?
Well, actually, we see kind of cycles of whooping cough usually, and this is just kind of an estimate, but usually every 5 years we see a little bit of an increase. Whooping cough, if you remember, there was quite a big outbreak in California about 3 years ago, I believe it was 2010, 2009, and they had some infant deaths associated with that outbreak. And you'll see sometimes things migrate, and so they had a big outbreak. Washington had a pretty decent-sized whooping cough outbreak this past year in 2011, 2012, and our 2012 numbers were much higher than what they've been in the past. I don't have Southeast-specific data, but I do know that there were 355 reported cases of whooping cough in Alaska during the 2012 season. 322 of those were confirmed by laboratory tests. So we saw a very large increase from 2011 when there were only 24 cases in Alaska.
Wow, that's significant. So if you just joined us, I'm talking with Kate Helfrich from the Public Health Center. It is World Immunization Week, and here in Juneau, the Public Health Center, actually here in Alaska, public health centers are offering free vaccinations. And if they need some more information, what's that number one more time?
A good number to call locally for the Juneau Public Health Center would be 465-3353. If you also wanted to go on to www.alaska.gov, there's also information on all of the public health centers in Alaska. So if you're in a different region, that's a good resource. You'll be able to figure out the numbers for the for your community's public health center to see what they're offering. But you can always give us a call, too, and we can get you connected.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
I'd cook up caboodles so no one would ever get hurt. If I was the head of this hospital here, I'd bring in a dump truck of sterilized dirt. I'd say, let the kids play, do whatever they say, and give them whatever they want for dessert. Needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally, noo. If doctors and nurses would rock to and fro, we could sit on their heads and say, giddy up, go! Ride them around and collect all the pills and pile them up into sliding down hills. Take off the stethoscopes, chuck the white coats, slide down the pills using bedpans for both. Yeah! Needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally, noodally. Syringes were squirt guns, I'd find some big ones. I'd fill them with punch or with soup left from lunch. Yeah. I'd go under my bed, and when somebody said, hey, that kid is in here, where'd that kid disappear? Well, I might squirt their shoe.
Good idea.
Just to see what they do.
Hey, you know,
if elephants came here to get themselves fixed, yeah, they'd sneeze with their trunks clothed up, paid off the brick. And a kid type thermometer isn't so fine for giant big elephant temperature time. You've got to be careful, don't lose it inside. Just if you get a mad, whoa, there's no place to hide.
Needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally, noodally, needally,
noodally,
needally, noodally.
Flew. I know what I do. Well, I'd float down the hall when the doc comes to call. Make up a story about hospital food and say, doc, my dinner just tastes so good that I saved some for you. Come on, take a big bite. The doctor would say, are you sure you're all right?
I am fine.
Yeah.
germs look like worms. We dip them in ink and we make them paint lines as they drain down the sink.
If pillows could talk, yeah, I know mine would say, get your head out of bed and go outside and play.
If the things in our song haven't happened, well, then, well, maybe we better just sing it again.
Come on!
Hello, Juno. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. On the phone, I am going to be talking with Lee Newman. Lee Newman is the author of Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. This book is published by Dial Press, and Lee, who grew up in Anchorage and Baltimore and had many visits up to the bush, she currently serves as the deputy editor of Oprah.com and as an editor-at-large for the indie press Black Balloon Publishing. Hello, Lee. Are you on the line?
Hi, sure am. Hi, Joan. How are you doing?
I am great. How are you? You're in Portland. You're on your way up to Alaska. Is that correct?
That's it. I leave tomorrow night. I can't wait, actually.
Yeah.
My friend made me some Alaskan-shaped cookies. She got an Alaskan cookie cutter, and she made me some Alaskan cookies to eat on the plane.
And what do they look like?
They look like the state of Alaska. They're like, they're like vanilla cookies, and then she put little blue sprinkles for her snow.
That is so sweet. Coming home. Well, Lee, I read your book, but before we jump right into your book, I want to talk a little bit about what people are saying about your book besides me. So the New York Daily News says, it feels like everyone thinks that he or she can pen a memoir these days, but Lee Newman is one of the few to have proven she really can. And what's more, she has good reasons for doing so. There's something hauntingly universal about her story. That's what the New York Daily News wrote about Still Points North, which just came out this year, 2013, by Dial Press. So, Lee, let's talk a little bit about your process. This is a memoir that you wrote about growing up in Anchorage and Baltimore and a very great Alaskan experience with your dad and growing up with basically the last frontier blood in your veins and how you acclimated everywhere else since then. So, has this been a story that you felt that you had to put to paper? Is it something that, because you were also a travel writer for a while.
Right. I mean, I didn't feel like I had to tell the story because, you know, I come from, you know, very private people. You know, I feel like they're very loving and wonderful people, but we don't always, you know, talk about things or write things down. You know, we come much from a culture where you sort of know where you stand with your family by how people are acting. You know, you sort of read everything into how people, what they do, which is, I think, a great measure for understanding someone is seeing what they do instead of what they say. But I was writing fiction for a long time as well as articles, and I never really thought about writing about my childhood because I assumed that everybody else had grown up, you know, flying single-prop planes and running into bears and fishing and hunting for caribou. And, you know, you think other people's childhoods are like your own until you know, for me, it came very late in life where I thought, no, my growing up was different than other people's. And it was great. It was this extraordinary experience that, you know, I was so lucky to have. And that's really where it started. It's right where the book started. I started writing about my dad, the great Alaskan dad. And from that minute, it was like I felt I was exactly in the right place. Like, I'd never felt that way before. I'd always felt like I was sort of writing well, but not about the right things. But when I started writing about my dad in Alaska, it was like, boom, you know. Instead of being dragged by little donkeys, I was being dragged by, you know, six white horses with little bells. Mm. Oh, this is what writing is, you know.
A dog mushing team. So there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
So how long did it take you once you started the process? I know you have, like, you're an editor. You've written. I want to talk about your essays here. So Lee's been published in the New York Times fiction section, the New York Tyrant, Vogue, the Oprah magazine, Condé Nast Bridges, the Modern Love column in the New York Times. And if you want to check out more about Lee, you could go to her webpage. Just Google her. It's Lee Newman, and she's got a blog, and her essays are there, and they're really very, very interesting, exceptionally well written too. But it's like 10 insanely nice things you could say to anybody, 7 gifts from the universe that everybody gets. You know, they're definitely fun. She's definitely got a very distinct voice. So once you started writing the memoir, how long did it take?
It took 3.5 years, almost 4 years. The thing was, I wrote the first 60 pages, and they've never changed. Those are the exact same first pages that I started with. But then the question is, you know, where do you go from there? And that really took me a long time. I wrote, you know, probably 400 pages. And then I tried to revise that and make it shorter. I knew it was too long. Eventually, I had to take out the whole middle of the book, 120 pages right out of the middle of the book at the very, like, last year.
Well, that's
that was very hard to do.
That's part of the process. You know, you're an editor. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it is. I think it's those deep cuts that stay with that make things great, or, you know, that's the difference between, you know, really succeeding and failing is coming to face those horrible, just like in life, you know, those, like, horrible, painful, deep decisions that we have to make that are totally, you don't want to do it. You know what you have to do. You don't want to do it. And then finally, if you can do it, it's good.
Yeah, that is true. So if you just joined us, I'm talking with Lee Newman, who's got a memoir out, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. It's published by Dial Press. And she is coming up to Alaska to do a tour. She's up at, she's with Sherry Simpson at University of Alaska in Anchorage on Wednesday night. She's doing a talk for 49 Writers, which is a writers group, a statewide writers group that's also in Anchorage. She's going to do a reading in Cyrano with a Pulitzer Prize. I think she's a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize.
She was a finalist. It's so awesome.
Yeah, and how do you pronounce that name?
Ewan Ivey.
Ewan Ivey, that's right. And then she'll be up in Fairbanks at Gulliver's Bookstore. So, Lee, it must be great to be coming home. Do you still come back up to Alaska a lot?
Yeah, I do. I usually come up once a year. I've got two boys, so I want them to experience Alaska the way I did. I want them to have a different way of living. And so, but, you know, sometimes we come up in Christmas. That's a whole thing. But the best times have been really the summer trips when they can fish, and they can get in a plane, they can go camping. My little 7-year-old caught a 19-inch rainbow the first time he came up. And, you know, that for him, from a kid living in a city, it's just a totally different way of living. And I want him to experience it as much as he can.
Right. Well, he's 7. There's a great little video on Lee's website, too. It's really great. But according to the video and also the book, Lee was catching 40-pound salmon at 8. So, and she was... And your dad and you got in quite a few close calls. Typical Alaskan stuff, but really off the bar for people who are not from the state.
Yeah, I know. The funny thing is that there's two different ways that people approach those stories. When I read them on the East Coast, people are like, oh, my gosh, they get so worried about me. They want to talk about, you know, how these dangerous things affected me. And then people, you know, from Alaska or even the Northwest say, oh, that reminds me of the time that, you know, I landed on a glacier, too, you know. And they sort of catch the joy. I mean, I'm not saying that almost dying is joyful, but there is sort of an exuberance to life, you know, having these experiences and living in the bush that I relish and that I wanted to come through in the book, you know, not just, oh, my gosh, we almost died. It's so scary.
Right.
You know, growing up, the way I did, too, I revered my father. I was always convinced he would save us, and he always did.
Right. And the thing is that to a certain type of men, it's almost a worldview that it almost becomes the norm. That it doesn't, it's not, everybody's got a war story, and the fact then they become a war story if you live through it. If not, we don't have a story to tell, unfortunately. But,
no, that is such a good point. That is such a good point. And I do think it is part of, like, the fabric. I mean, probably the reason why I like to write so much is I grew up with my dad and his friends telling stories about the time they fought off the bear tinned ham, you know, one of those dance hams, or, you know, the time that somebody fell in, you know, a Class 4 Rapids and floated down the street. And that kind of, like, campfire talk, that kind of regaling story is so much a part of my culture that when I sat down to write, it made it, you know, it was sort of like writing campfire stories in a way. It had that feel to me sometimes. And secondly, I also think that this kind of survival culture makes for kind of a kind of person that tends to be very self-reliant, you know, has a very good understanding of, you know, what life and, I don't want to exaggerate, but death are, and it's a different way of living when you live that way or when you grow up that way. You understand things in a different way. It's deeply profound. It changes how I live. It affects very much how I make decisions. But just from everything, I mean, you know, how I spend my time, who I spend my time with, what I think about. And I was trying to talk about that in the book a lot, you know.
No, I think it definitely comes through. I think it definitely comes through. About, and also that, you know, you could take someone from Alaska, put her somewhere else at a young age, but it was Alaska was your beacon home. You know, that was definitely your North Star that you needed to get back to Alaska.
Very much so. I mean, I consider the book very much a love story, to, a love letter to Alaska. Because no matter where I went, I did. I went as far away as Nepal tracking tigers. I went to the Galapagos. You know, I lived all over the world as my job as a travel writer, but all I ever really thought about was Alaska and my time there. I've always longed and missed for it, and it has like a very big mythical place in my heart and my brain.
No, I totally understand what you're saying. It's the imprint, and it's the imprint on the book. It's definitely everywhere.
Yeah.
That is very much who you are. But also, it's also telling. We were talking when you were in growing up. I don't want to, you know, ask you your age, but we're talking about Anchorage in the 70s, aren't we? Like 70s,
yeah.
80s.
I'm 41. It's okay. I don't care. I'm 41 years old.
Well, I'm not. That's not the point. The point is that Anchorage is so different now than it was then.
Yeah. That's true. That is true. And sometimes I feel like I wrote this book, and you know, I didn't want to go up and investigate things too much. I wanted it to be a memoir, in a sense of the Alaska that I knew. Because the Alaska that I knew was very much an Alaska of the last frontier. You know, I feel like things have changed. You know, when my parents were living up there, we didn't have there was no car dealerships most of the time. If you wanted to buy a car, you had to go to the spring and then drive it up for certain cars.
Right. It was definitely a snapshot of a time. Lee, are you there? I feel like I'm losing you. Are you there? I think that we might have lost Lee, which is unfortunate. Yep, we definitely lost Lee. But most of that interview was over. I'm going to call her back, see if we could get her back, but we might not be able to do that. But as I said, she's written this book, Still Points North, One Alaskan Childhood, One Grown-Up World, One Long Journey Home. You could check out more about Lee at her website if you just go online and search for Lee Newman. And she'll be coming up to Alaska, unfortunately not Juneau, but Anchorage and Fairbanks, to promote her book. And she is currently the editor of Oprah.com. Okay, we'll be back in just a few minutes.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 22nd of April, 2013. Today is Earth Day, a day first observed in 1970 at the prompting of Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. About 20 million people participated in the first Earth Day, April 22, 1970, and soon after came the formation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. It became an international event in 1990, events in 141 countries. In 2000, Earth Day was coordinated on the Internet. According to the Earth Day Network, Earth Day is celebrated, observed in some form by a billion people every year. It's the birthday of the Enlightenment philosopher Immanuel Kant, born in Königsberg, Prussia, in 1724. He was professor of logic and metaphysics at the university there, and never ventured more than 50 miles from his hometown. Immanuel Kant believed that travel was not necessary to solve the problems of philosophy. His most influential work, The Critique of Pure Reason, in 1781, in which he argued against empiricism and rationalism. It's the birthday of the man who once wrote, "Love and scandal are the best sweeteners of tea." Henry Fielding, the novelist, born in Somerset, England, 1707. He started out writing for the stage. He was writing political satires, and there were many people in government who did not take kindly to that. And so, in 1737, Parliament passed the Theatrical Licensing Act, which required plays to be approved by the Lord Chamberlain. And Henry Fielding, knowing that none of his plays were likely to be approved, retired from the stage, became a novelist, and wrote The History of Tom Jones, a Foundling, the story of a lusty, good-hearted young man who falls in love with his neighbor's daughter. It's the birthday of the legendary jazz bassist and composer Charles Mingus, born in Nogales, Arizona, in 1922. And it's the birthday of the poet Louise Glück, born in New York City, 1943, her father, an immigrant from Hungary, helped to invent the X-Acto knife. She won the Pulitzer Prize for her collection, The Wild Iris, in 1992. Louise Glick, who said she tends to write poems that operate on a vertical axis of transcendence and grief, and who had a word of wisdom for young poets, she said, it never gets easier to write. Here's a poem for today by Jane Hirschfield, entitled, For What Binds Us. There are names for what binds us, strong forces, weak forces, look around, you can see them, the skin that forms in a half-empty cup, nails rusting into the places they join, joints dovetailed on their own weight, the way things stay so solidly wherever they've been set down, and gravity, scientists say, is weak, and see how the flesh grows back across a wound with a great vehemence, more strong than the simple, untested surface before. There's a name for it on horses when it comes back darker and raised, proud flesh, as all flesh is proud of its wounds, wears them as honors given out after battle, small triumphs pinned to the chest. And when two people have loved each other, see how it is like a scar between their bodies, stronger, darker, and proud, how the black cord makes of them a single fabric that nothing can tear or mend. A poem by Jane Hirschfield, For What Binds Us, from her collection of Gravity and Angels, published by Wesleyan University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Produced by Kathy Roach, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
One day, all babies will be born healthy, but we have to walk to get there. You can help by joining your friends and neighbors and the March of Dimes for the March for Babies Walk on May 11th at the Twin Lakes Park. 9 a.m. is check-in time, and the walk starts at 10. Register online today at marchforbabies.org and walk for healthy babies. This message is brought to you by the March of Dimes.
Hello, Juno. This is Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Joan Pardis. In the studio with me today is Julie Niederhauser from the Alaska State Library and Margaret O'Neill from the Juneau Economic Development Council. They're here to talk about Money Smart Week. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
So, Julie, tell us a little bit about Money Smart Week.
Well, Money Smart Week started in Chicago with the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago about 10 years ago, and it began as a collaboration of businesses and organizations in Chicago that wanted to promote financial literacy. And they've been doing it for 10 years, and it was very successful and grew every year, and libraries have always participated in Money Smart Week. But 3 years ago, they asked the American Library Association to become a formal partner with them because they knew that libraries can really help them expand out into the public with the consumer financial literacy piece. So we're proud to be participating in Money Smart Week this year here at the Alaska State Library, and we have three programs lined up. On April 23rd, we have Retirement Income Planning and Portfolio. Zach Cohan and Harold Heidersdorf from Merrill Lynch will be given a 45-minute presentation that will cover equities versus fixed income, asset allocation, and income in retirement and investment options for retirees. And on Wednesday, we have Wednesday, April 24th, we have Financing Your Growing Business, and Margaret O'Neill will be talking about what she's going to be presenting in just a minute. And then on Friday, we have Paying Off Debt. And Sarah Lewis from the Cooperative Extension will give a 45-minute presentation covering ways to increase family and financial resilience through strategies for paying off debt, assessing good versus bad debt, what to pay off first, and managing credit card debt and planning a debt payoff schedule. And I think all of these are really timely topics, and I know they're going to have a good turnout.
So, Julie, where are these events taking place and what time?
Well, they're going to be – all of the events are scheduled from 12:15 to 1 p.m. at the Alaska State Library. We're located on the 8th floor of the State Office Building. We're not the historical library. You want to go on the other side of the atrium. We're on the information services side, and they'll be right in that large reading area.
And all these workshops are free, is that correct?
They absolutely are free.
That sounds great. So, Margaret, let's talk a little bit about financing your growing business. Your talk on Wednesday, April 24th, will take place from 12:15 to 1.
Right. Well, a lot of businesses that, you know, start out of the shoestring or the owner's funds when they start to expand, they need money. They might not have the track record to get bank financing. And so a couple of years ago, with some support from the USDA Rural Business Services, we put together a workshop about where Southeast Alaskan businesses could go to get money. And we developed an interactive website that shows different sources of funding for, depending on what kind of business you're in, if it's a retail or restaurant business or a seasonal business or fishing operation or things like that. It's really good, these kind of workshops, to give people an opportunity to kind of pitch their ideas. And I was trying to do stump the chump sometimes to see if I can give them ideas about where to get money. But people learn from each other too. So if anybody's in business and wants to know where they can get some more money to help their business grow, then I hope they'll come to the workshop.
Okay, so we're talking with Margaret O'Neill from the Juneau Economic Development Council. She's going to present one of the seminars, one of the three seminars for Money Smart Week at the Alaska State Library. So, Margaret, I have another question about your presentation on Wednesday at 12:15. So it's financing your growing business. So this is not for people who have a startup idea. This is somebody who has an existing business already?
If they are a startup, of course, it's much harder, but I think they should come too. excuse me. The workshop that I'm doing is the one that's more targeted towards businesses. The other ones are for consumers or personal finance. And we have a loan program ourselves at JADC that we have with City Money. And, you know, I can help people get funding from different sources. But it is tougher with startups, but it's good for them to have some tools in their kit, you know, to start out with, so that they can sort of plan. But there are ways to get money out of your family and friends too.
Oh, she's got lots of secrets, I think, that she's willing to share. So that it will be Wednesday, April 24th. But tomorrow at 12:15, and then on Friday, there are two other seminars. Retirement Income Planning is Tuesday at 12:15, and Friday is Paying Off Debt. And that seems very timely, and it's at 12:15. Anything else you want to say about, I'm asking Julie, is there anything else you want to say about Money Smart Week and its partnerships with the Alaska State Library?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, we're the first library in Alaska to participate in Money Smart Week, and we are hoping to model it for public libraries around the state and show them how easy it is to work with nonprofits and businesses and financial institutions in their areas and help promote financial literacy. It's an important skill that all of us need. We need to know how to manage our money wisely so that we can have our money working for us and we can live the lives that we want to live.
Right.
So
it seems like in the last, I don't know, maybe 5 years, financial literacy seems to be the buzzword, that it's been coined, and lots of people are talking about how to make your money work for you, how to make your money go as far as it possibly can.
Well, people have been living under mountains of debt across the country, and you know, there's foreclosures and all those things. It's important to, like she said, make your money work for you instead of the other way around.
And I want to add that the Alaska State Library, we do webinars, monthly webinars, and we have been doing, I think we've done it a couple of times. We have a webinar that is on small business resources, and it does kind of point people into the direction of resources that they can go to if they're interested in starting their own business. It's on our library website under... oh, my goodness, I'm blanking out here. It's library.alaska.gov, and if they go to state employees, there will be a link on the lower right-hand side. It says archived webinars, and people can click on that, and they can view the webinar in entirety. So if they're looking to start their own business, that's where they can go.
That sounds so great. So here we have Alaska State Literacy. We have the Juneau Economic Development Council offering free webinars to help you navigate the world of finances, whether you're talking about your own particular finances, your own personal finances, or your growing business. Well, and ladies, do you have anything else to say before we have to sign off?
Just bring your questions.
Yeah. Yes, we hope to see. We hope to have a really good turnout, and we want to thank KTOO for inviting us to this radio show.
Okay.
Thank you.
Also, it seems like for more information, you can call 465-2916 to get the Scooby on all these different things and more. So thank you, ladies, for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
When I was just a child, my life was oh so simple, and the ways of the great world seemed strange and funny. Then when I was a young man, I learned of that machine. Turns out all those bales of precious money.
Hello, Juno. This is Juno Afternoon. You are listening on KTOO. Here in the studio, we have three thespians from Latitude at 58. They're doing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland this weekend. So in the studio, I have Shannon Olmsted. Hi, Shannon.
Hi.
Molly York.
Hi.
Hi. And Jillian Smith.
Hi.
Hi. So we have two actors who are playing Alice. I understand there's five Alices in this production, and then Shannon is playing the frog footman. So let's get to the details first. It's April 26th through 28th at McPheeters Hall, downtown, downstairs at the Holy Trinity Church, 4th and Gold. And it's Friday and Saturday at 7, Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m. You could get tickets from cast members who are at the door, and I suggest you do that because it's a small space, and I hear that things are selling out. So I'm going to Molly is 11, and Jillian is 12, and they're both playing Alice. So let's start with Molly, the youngest here. So why are there five Alices, and what is your Alice all about?
Well, there are five Alices because they thought it would be better to give children a better chance of being Alice because obviously when everybody was trying out, everybody wanted to try Alice, you know, so they thought it might be better if there were five of them so kids could have more chances to try out. Also, it's a lot of pressure and work for one kid to memorize all the Alice parts, so they just decided to split it up a little bit. And because Alice is kind of curious and she likes to be kind of talk to herself as two people, so they kind of have her be like that. And my Alice is kind of the moody Alice. We each have a different Alice. I'm the one whose mood swings a lot. All of a sudden I'm sad, I'm happy, I'm angry, you know. So
that sounds like a big emotional range for a young actor on a stage. That should be very fun.
Yeah.
So, Jillian, what's your Alice like?
Oh, my Alice, she's kind of a know-it-all. She brags a lot about all of her knowledge to a variety of characters.
That's funny. And are you like that in real life, or is it a stretch for you to do that?
A little bit of both.
A little bit of both. And then the two other Alices, they have completely different, like, emotional range. Is that what you're saying, that each one of them has, like, a different facet of Elizabeth, of Alice?
Yeah, just a bit. Like, for example, there's one who's kind of sassy, and another who's
more like
kind of, she loves nature, and she's really relaxed. So, yeah, there's a variety of character.
Okay. And then Shannon is the frog footman. Have you been involved with theater before?
Once.
And when was that?
That was 2 years ago. The first year, yeah.
And what production was it?
That was Mr. Sunshine.
Oh, yeah. So that was with the same theater company.
Yeah.
That was actually their first one, wasn't it? Their first.
Yeah.
So the correct name of it is Theater at Latitude 58, and this is their fifth production. They did four on stage, and they did a radio play, and Shannon was in the very first one. So was it a no-brainer for you to go for this, to try out for this play, or was it a stretch? Or
it was kind of a stretch. My friends were in it, and you know, I wanted to try it, so it's going good so far.
Okay. And Shannon, at 14, are you one of the oldest people in the play, or are there people older than you?
Yeah, I'm one of the oldest.
You're one of the oldest. Okay. And how many people are in this production?
50.
There are 50 people in this production.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
On the stage.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, on a small stage at McPheeters Hall. Oh, that sounds great. I have my tickets for Saturday night. I'm really looking forward to it. And how long have you been rehearsing?
For about 2 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So you're in Tech Week, I would imagine, in dress rehearsals.
Mm-hmm.
And are you ready? Are you ready for the show?
Yes.
Okay. Let's go back to the Alices. So when people go, is this going to be like the movie? Like, when you go, do you think people should think more book or more movie? Jillian's going to answer this.
Definitely the book. It's a lot of the material is right out of the book. But I think both the movie and the book, people who love both of those will enjoy this production a lot because there are songs from the movie, too.
Okay, so it's a musical.
There are several songs.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. And Jillian, is this your first time on the stage?
No. This is my second play with Theater at Latitude 58, and I've been involved with several other theater programs before that.
Okay. And what about you, Molly? You're 11. You're the youngest actor in the studio right now. You might not be the youngest in the production, but right now. Is this your first play?
It is. It's my very, very first play.
Wow. Did you count? How many lines did you have to remember?
Quite a few. I couldn't really put a specific number on there, but quite a few. I have done, like, one small neighborhood play that just me and some other kids did, but it wasn't obviously very big at all. So, but I've always liked to memorize. I memorize scripture a lot. So.
Oh, good. All right, so now I have a question for any of you who could answer this. So what was the big takeaway? What was the big aha of working on a production, working so hard to get something, you know, ready for the public with so many people? Does anybody have an answer to that? But what was, like, the best part of this whole thing? Was it seeing everybody every week? Was it, you know, seeing it come together when, you know, you were working on pieces of it first? It looks like Shannon has.
Yeah. Just being around my friends and having fun with everyone. We had a cast party a couple nights ago. It was awesome. And just acting for people. It's really fun.
Hmm. That sounds great. Oh, go ahead, Molly.
I love the script because it's really for, like, all ages. I mean, just for adults and for kids, and just it's just enjoyable for all audiences. It's a really neat script. So it's just good for, like, everybody to watch, from adults to children, for everywhere in between, you know.
Right. Jillian, do you have anything to add about
that? Yeah, I agree with Molly. It's really fun. There's a lot of crazy characters to watch, and there are some funny moments, too. So, yeah, it's great.
It sounds great. So if you're just joining us, I'm talking to three members of the cast of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. That's going to be this weekend. Theater at Latitude 58 is putting on this production. Cinnamon Simpson and Karen Allen directed, and it's April 26th through 28th. And for more information, you could check out Theater at Latitude 58 on the website. So thanks. We'll see you all this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Earth Day. Celebrate the Earth by riding the winds of spring. From a canyon in the west, where western meadowlarks sing, morning doves call, black-billed magpies chatter. To the boundary waters of Minnesota, where a pair of common loons returns to breed and raise their young. Spring peepers sing for mates. And now, from Minnesota to an old-growth hardwood forest in North Carolina, where warblers and vireos sing and woodpeckers drum. When choosing a planet, we all made a very good choice. Sounds were recorded by Gordon Hempton. You'll find a link to his work at birdnote.org. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation.
Strings at the Shrine, Brahms Away, Mendelssohn, and much, much more. Classical music is an integral part of Juno Jazz and Classics, and this 27th year is no different. Artists like Robert Belinich, the Jasper String Quartet, and Paul Rosenthal continue the tradition of a mix of new and returning artists. More information about them, the concerts, and the festival at jazzandclassics.org. Music, magic. Don't miss it. This message is brought to you by Juno Jazz and Classics.
What is I'd be a sin if I can't help falling in love with you. Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things were meant to be. Take my hand, take my whole life too, 'cause I can't help falling in love with you. Why? Only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay? Would it be
That was Arlo Guthrie. Arlo Guthrie is going to be coming to Juneau May 3rd through the Juneau Jazz and Classics. It is a great lineup this summer. Check it out at Juneau Jazz and Classics. Just search them on the web and get your tickets. Okay, here this week, we've got rain diminishing this evening, partly cloudy tomorrow in the morning, then becoming cloudier with a chance of rain in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, rain. Wednesday, rain. Rain and clouds through the rest of the week. To get some sunshine, turn into Pat Moore tomorrow at 3 o'clock for Juneau Afternoon. He'll be talking about Glory Hole's Empty Bowls. That's this Sunday. He'll be talking to magician Richard Hatch about his upcoming shows in the capital city. They'll get a preview of Wednesday's Pillar of America speaker, Sean Harper. And he'll be talking to Kate Jensen of the Gold Belt Heritage Institute about the Investigating Traditional Knowledge course. Sounds like a great show. So that's tomorrow at 3. Later on today, of course, All Things Considered are next, but on KRNN, we've got Tideline with Katie B at 5 o'clock, Garden of Love with Jane at 7, On the Corner with Doug at 9 p.m. That's on KRNN. Here we are at KTOO, All Things Considered next. Talk to you next week.
KTOO Juneau.
We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay area, tuned to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear K2 on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive K2 on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org.
Cathedral bells, a moment of silence. Boston today remembered the victims of last week's bombings and shootings.
And the role of social media during the week that followed the marathon bombing.
It's Monday, April 22nd, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Also this hour, the pitfalls of giving advice about cars.
Career guidance from Ken Caldera, whose bachelor's degree was in philosophy and whose career has been in climate change.
I always tell my postdocs and graduate students that we always try to say the first word on a subject, not the last word on it.